Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. One of the Bay Area's most famous destinations is Alcatraz. It attracts 1.5 million visitors every year. Most people come to see the former maximum security penitentiary, which the federal government operated from 1934 to 1963. But scrawled on the walls, visitors from around the world can see graffiti from the occupation of Alcatraz. 50 years ago, on November 20th, 1969, dozens of Native activists started what would become a 19-month-long political protest. Before it became a tourism hotspot, the shuttered prison had been declared surplus government property, so occupation organizers used the 1868 Treaty of Fort Laramie to take back the island. The occupation led to fundamental changes for the rights of indigenous people across the country. Today's guest, Dr. Lineta Warjacht, was the leader of the occupation in 1969. Before Alcatraz, Lineta Warjacht became the first Native student at UC Berkeley in 1968. She was part of the group Native Students United, which landed on and occupied Alcatraz. She also helped lead the Third World Liberation Front and the creation of Native American Studies at UC Berkeley. Dr. Lineta Warjacht is a member of the Shoshone-Bannock Tribes. She's president of Indigenous Visions Network and a distinguished professor at Boise State University. Dr. Lineta Warjacht is out with a new book called Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. And she is in the Bay Area doing events around the 50th anniversary of the occupation of Alcatraz. Hi, Dr. Warjacht. Thank you so much for coming in.
Good morning.
It's great to have you. I loved your book, and I just want to read part of your intro. You write, "As a Native American Indigenous woman, my story is about the genocidal aftermath of the American Indian Wars barely over 100 years ago in the Western territories of the U.S. Native people still carry the agony and pain of historical trauma across the generations. Bad governmental control has led to poverty, high suicide rates, alcoholism, drugs, malnutrition, and other colonial impacts that are alive throughout Native communities, Indian reservations, and urban Native strongholds." When you sat down to write your story, what became your ultimate goal?
I just wanted to make sure we have a story that tells the truth about what happened. Because as much as I can see in any of the history books, I still don't see it. I don't see where they're telling the truth. And my objective was to make sure that the story got out. And it's been 50 years since we took Alcatraz, and I needed to make sure that I told that story as well. I don't want to take the credit for being the only leader, because we had many various leaders and students that took the island. And we had Richard Oakes, who was the chair of the student group from San Francisco State, and I was the chair of the student group from UC Berkeley. And together we were able to take Alcatraz. And we had many other leaders as well, such as, you know, who heads up security, cooks, the Rock Schoolhouse, and, you know, the various functions and duties we had on the island. So we had a lot of really good people with great leadership, community skills.
What has it been like for you doing all of these events and finishing this book when you think back? Well, we're going to talk about your life overall, but also just the occupation and how powerful that was.
I never had any idea that it would be as impacting as it was. I mean, we were just doing what we thought was right, and we wanted, you know, our treaties to be recognized. Every single one of them had been broken, over 565 treaties with tribes, and some were not even ratified. So we wanted to make sure that the government knew that we were upset about all the injustices and on the reservation and the poverty and the racism and discrimination that many of our people were going through.
You say something that I think is so important. On the reservation, there was extreme poverty. And off of the reservation, there was extreme discrimination. So if you wanted to try to get away from the poverty and, quote, assimilate and get a job, it was incredibly hard because it was almost impossible to get a job. And there were no Indians or dog signs all over the place. I mean, a lot of people don't know that even up in Northern California in Ukiah, where my great-grandmother lived, she had to deal with those signs.
That's right. And then after they passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, they took down the no Indians or dogs allowed signs, but the feeling was still there. So it was still pretty hot.
You talked about the truth and wanting to get out the truth, and you have this incredible section about this in your book. You write, "As I research and examine our past, I have already gone through all the varying stages of rage and defiance, and I feel deeply saddened by the increasing awareness about the truth of our history. Yet I must be able to tell my story and remain positive in the face of harsh truths." Can you talk more about that? Because I learned so much about these laws that I just didn't really know much about. I mean, a lot of people know about the Indian Removal Act, but how deep is their knowledge?
Well, among those acts were the legislation that was imposed to take all the children away from the parents and put them in government and Christian boarding schools. And also following that law was the legislation to take away our languages, our religions, our dancing, our singing, our languages. They made everything illegal. So it was a very difficult time for everyone, and then it was just mass slaughter out in the country.
Just to go over a few of these laws, as you write, and this is important, in 1776, the formalization of the U.S. Constitution, which is getting a lot of attention right now because of the impeachment hearings, they excluded Indians in the U.S. government, contained specific language that established Indians separately by race. Women were excluded, no mention of black people. You write, "Much like the present in 1830, Congress supported the American public and political allies to open up more Indian lands to white settlement through the passage of the Indian Removal Act, which resulted in the Cherokee Trail of Tears."
That's right. It was a really horrible time for everybody.
And this really led to the westward expansion?
Yes.
As you write, it commenced with the railroad and the gold rushes into the West. The plan was to move all tribes west of the Mississippi into the state of Oklahoma.
That's right. And then they tried to take all of the tribes west of Oklahoma and put them into the whole state of Oklahoma and make that just all Indian territory. But they couldn't quite get a grasp on that in the West, because by then tribes were building up to do some resistance. Whereas before, when they first came over, then nobody was prepared to deal with the violence that apparently was there. They thought they could talk to the people, the settlers, the colonists. They thought they could work out agreements. And they were willing to share, but, you know, they didn't know that they would just get killed.
Mm. When did you first learn about this?
I don't really know. I just know that my dad would always tell me, he'd say, "Do you see that pile of ants over there?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you treat those ants respectfully, because someone's going to go over there and they're going to kick it, or they're going to burn it, or they're going to try to destroy it. And you see all those little ants running away?" He says, "That's us." So here we are, generations, you know, the children and the grandchildren of those ants that escaped, you know, that destruction done to their homes.
You also mentioned the treaties, and this is another concept that people are very familiar with, but probably not the details. What would you say is most important to know about these treaties? As you write, they were coercive tools used as basically a death warrant to force the tribes to leave their homelands, give the U.S. Congress access, and allow even more lands to be taken under the threat of violence.
Yeah, it was the only thing that we had to just keep them from killing us, because they would just murder us. So they had to have use those treaties as tools, even though we knew it probably, I mean, who knows how long those treaties would be good, but it was just some way to keep them from stopping the slaughter.
In this piece of information I was not aware of, Supreme Court Justice John Marshall ruled in Cherokee Nation versus Georgia in 1831 that the Indians have an unquestionable right to the lands they occupy until that right shall be extinguished by a voluntary secession to the U.S. government. This is very important. This was a really important ruling.
Yes, it was, but it was ignored
by
President
Andrew Jackson.
Andrew Jackson, right.
So he completely ignored this ruling and then ordered the military to remove Cherokees, Choctaw, Chickasaw Creek, and Seminoles east of the Mississippi River.
That's right. He said, well, that's your opinion, but see if you can carry it out. Then he just ordered his troops to move everyone.
It's so interesting because what we hear today is about the laws of this country and how strong they are, especially under someone like Trump. You can use the law. In many other countries, you cannot, to secure your rights. But look at how they completely ignored this one.
Exactly. We've just been invisible people for so long.
When you were doing research for this, because as I said, there's so much information about laws in here, what came up for you as you were going back to even the late 1700s and the 1800s writing about these laws?
Well, I always knew about them, and I've known many lawyers and law professors that know about them as well. And I don't see anybody really talking about it, though, or getting it out because maybe they have political ambitions or, you know, maybe there's something they want to do with their life. And once they start talking the truth, then they'll just be excommunicated.
Right. Do you have any hope with, now that we have two Native American women, Democrats in Congress, do you think that, I mean, what would you like them to do to raise awareness about all of this?
Well, it would help if they read my book.
Yes, read the book. It's Dr. Lenata Warjack. The book is Native Resistance, an Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. It's really an amazing book. Dr. Lenata Warjack was one of the leaders of the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969. She was the first Native student at UC Berkeley in 1968. She helped lead the Third World Liberation Front and the creation of Native American Studies at UC Berkeley. I wanted to go back and talk about a little bit about your upbringing. As you can see, I have so many notes from your book here. You were born after World War II ended in October 1945, and your parents were welders on battleships. They left the reservation early to work on these battleships, like so many Native Americans at the time. Living there was really difficult. And they worked in Portland, Oregon, and then returned home to Idaho. Tell us about your mom, because she found out that she could easily access public places by claiming to be French.
Yes, my mom was a very beautiful half-breed, but what they call a half-breed, I guess in our language, they say new arrival. And what that is, she couldn't be white and she couldn't be Native, so she was always discriminated by both. So she found out, well, since she couldn't get into public places, she'll just claim to be French. And she was able to get in, and she had this kind of creamy milk complexion, you know, where she could get away with that. So she thought, well, I want all my family to be accepted as well. So she changed our family name to Boyer so that we could all be French and be accepted into society.
How did your mom explain that to you and your siblings?
Well, she never really said too much about it, but we just kind of knew how she was because her Indian name, well, whenever she spoke, like when I got kicked out of the first grade because my birth date wasn't technically the right date. So she went over there and she talked to the superintendent and she cussed him out and she got her way and he gave me a lollipop and walked me back to class and I was just so amazed. I thought, wow, I wish I could be like that. You know, to be able to speak up and just state your case. And then later on I found out that her Indian name meant shot from a gun.
Wow. Shot from a gun.
Right.
To Boye.
Yeah.
That's a big jump.
So she was making all these changes. I was watching her, though. I mean, I was just, a young girl, but I took it all in.
And again, we talked about the no Indians or dogs allowed sign, but you write you were not allowed to eat in restaurants or go into bars or public places. You could not use the same toilet facilities or drink from the same water fountains, and you could only sit on the left side of the movie theaters.
Right.
What was that about, a left side of the movie theater?
I don't know, but as I got older, I would just go sit wherever I wanted. I just went and I ignored him when I was little and just did whatever I wanted after a while. And after a while, it didn't really matter.
Right. Well, and then once you changed your name to Boyer, and as you write, your parents were trilingual. They were fluent in Shoshone and Bannock. They taught you the English language because, like so many natives, they didn't want you to go through the discrimination and the beatings
right.
that people endured. So what did change for you once that last name was changed and your family tried to kind of pass as French?
I was able to get through school at the top of the class because they taught me English and math before I even started. I could write, and I could write. So I just excelled to the top of the class all the way through grade school, and nobody ever really regarded me as being a native. And I didn't know that because when I started school, my dad told me to never be ashamed of who I was as a native person because this whole country is our country. And I said, okay, Daddy. I didn't really know what that meant, but I found out later on what it meant. And when I started junior high and we had to wear dresses, except for the Indian girls who came from the reservation, they could wear their Levi's. So I would wear my Levi's and then all of a sudden my teachers would say, why are you wearing those dirty old Levi's when you have the prettiest little dresses? And I'd say, my Levi's aren't dirty. I washed them out last night. And then when I saw that my grades were turning from A's to C's, then I knew that the pressure was on. And then all my white friends would say, why are you wearing Levi's? You're not an Indian. And I'd say, well, yes, I am. So then I didn't have any friends anymore.
Wow.
But I went all the way through grade school with them, top of the class, and, I never had to deal with that.
And how old were you at this time when the Levi's incident happened?
I was 12.
Wow. So you had to deal with this when you were 12.
Mm-hmm.
And you have stories in here, like one of your white friends, Patsy, said, do you know that Indians stink? And you said, I'm an Indian. Do I stink? And you write, I will never forget how her eyes about popped out of her head.
It's true. Her blue eyes just went in a circle, two circles, and she was so shocked. And I thought, well, I always knew who I was going through grade school, but I guess they never did classify me like that because the other Native students sat in the back of the class and were good artists because they couldn't speak the language. And so everybody just figured they were stupid or dumb. And, that's how that stigma got attached to us. But even after that, we went through the language barrier and everybody spoke English, that stigma still lasted. So it's still continued on.
I thought that part was so interesting, how you would go to the library and check out Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys mysteries, but the other kids didn't do this, the other Indian kids,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't know English. And so I think this is so interesting because when you think about national media coverage on reservations, it's always about suicide, poverty, and now missing and murdered Indigenous women, which is right. so incredibly important. But the context is usually missing. And you write, Native kids were already destroyed academically, psychologically, and socially. By the time we got to the sixth grade, they had been robbed of their self-esteem and their education.
That's right.
And that still is with us today.
Still the same thing, yeah.
Can you talk about this? Because your perspective is so interesting, given that your parents taught you English and math, and that you kind of passed as maybe a French girl.
Mm-hmm.
And then the things that you experienced when people realized you were Indian.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Native students still had their language, and it was hard for them to break those barriers into the English language and to learn. So they were treated differently. You know, they were regarded as, you know, dirty stink Indians and too dumb to learn. But so it did. It just robbed them of their academic potential and their self-esteem. And I don't know any one of them that I went to school with that's alive today.
Wow. Not one of them.
Right. And here I am. I'm 74, but I don't have anyone on the reservation who I knew at the time that I went to school.
That is amazing. And here you are on book tour and talking about what happened at Alcatraz.
Well, you have to really walk the talk, you know, if you're going to be out there and do anything to make any change, then you have to take care of yourself as well, and you can't get involved in drugs and alcohol or anything that would tear you down, because you won't have the strength, your body won't be able to handle that over the years. So I've just tried to take care of myself the best I could. And that's why I'm the only one alive today.
Wow.
You know, of everyone that I was working with at the time.
And I think, and maybe you can talk about this a little more, when the media focus on the suicide, the poverty, the alcoholism, the missing and murdered Indigenous women, how would, I'm just thinking of the context that's missing. And there's so much. Just having your culture ripped from you, being thrown on a reservation where you can't, I mean, the land might be in bad shape. And then even something as basic as not knowing English, and so your peers assume that you're dumb. How do you even get out of that?
I know. It's it's a difficult thing to have to try to aspire and get out of, because you know, the government laws are holding you down. And, of course, they control the economics on the reservation, which is only, they only provide about a third of that funding that goes to the reservation. So you have two-thirds of the people out there trying to survive. And, of course, a long time ago, you know, it went underground where we tried to promote our beadwork and our culture through making items, and that's still what happens today. But then the younger people that don't know their culture, how to make beadwork items, then you know they just go to alcohol and drugs as a way to make a means for a living. And you know, it's not good. The school system is still discriminating, although, you know, there are those who are able to get through. And even if they establish a positive academic foundation, then there's still the cultural side that needs to be balanced with their culture so that they know and understand, you know, how to go forward into the world and balance those two standards.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Lineta Warjack, one of the leaders of the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969. 50 years ago, on November 20th, 1969, dozens of Native activists started what would become a 19-month-long political protest. Dr. Warjack is out with a new book called Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Lineta Warjack about her incredible new book, Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. Dr. Warjack was one of the leaders of the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969. She became the first Native student at UC Berkeley in 1968 and helped lead the Third World Liberation Front and the creation of Native American Studies at UC Berkeley. Lineta Warjack is a member of the Shoshone-Bannock Tribes, is president of Indigenous Visions Network, and a distinguished professor at Boise State University. Dr. Warjack, before the break, we were talking about the historical and generational trauma that so many youth deal with today. And while we were talking, I remembered NPR recently had a piece. It's a new report called Closing the Water Access Gap in the United States. It shows that more than 2 million Americans live without water, and Native Americans are more likely to have trouble accessing water than any other group. They've got a photo of a woman here, Darlene Yazzie, a member of the Navajo Nation, who hauls water from a windmill 5 miles from her house for her sheep. Officials tell her it's unsafe for humans but okay for livestock. So just that alone, what message does that send to the young people? Sorry, in 2019, in this wealthy country, we can't provide water to your home?
And it doesn't take that many brains to figure out that if the sheep are drinking arsenic water, then it goes into the sheep, and that's their food, and they're going to eat it, and they're going to get it too. So you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know and understand that. And children are smart. They figure it out.
What changes would you like to see? I think about this a lot. When you talk about the reservation, for example, where there's a lot of poverty and some communities are just getting mailboxes for the first time.
Yeah.
I mean, what it's just within a country with so much money. Then again, you're in the Bay Area right now. I'm sure you're shocked to see so many bodies on the streets here.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
When we're talking about impoverished reservations, Native American, what changes would you like to see? I don't think we talk about that enough.
Well, it's pretty much the governmental control, because we don't have a voice. We don't have access to legislation that impacts us. The legislation that's passed for reservations is, it only impacts us, but we never have any voice in that. We have nothing to contribute. They don't want to listen to anything that we have to say about it. If we say, well, this isn't right because it's going to impact us here and it's going to hurt that, and you know, what you could say is this. I mean, we just don't have any voice in that legislation that controls us, and it's always been that way. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they tricked us into the propaganda of tribal sovereignty, where tribes are sovereign, but that also means that you don't have any civil liberties on the reservation. And so if anyone challenges that, then it's challenging the sovereignty that the tribes are enjoying, but they're not really enjoying that much anyway because the government still controls. If the tribal council goes against something that is not to the benefit of the outside public, then they'll just step in and they'll change it. So we need a lot more support from the federal government.
Right.
And right now, we're just not getting that, especially now, as a matter of fact, we've digressed to the termination era again. After all the fight and the struggle that everybody put into it, and now we're going backwards, and it's really frightening, you know, because we are all in crisis now, and it's not just our fight, but it's everybody's, if they realize it.
And I really don't want to bring Trump into this conversation, but it is amazing when you think that he chose the Andrew Jackson portrait for the Oval Office. I think that just says so much about where we are right now.
Well, he knows. The first executive order he signed was to allow the Dakota Access Line pipeline to go on the reservation, even after the Standing Rock resistance that drew so many people and tribes together to fight that. You know, he just allowed it. And now we've got oil in the water.
Mm. There was a major leak recently.
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk about what happened after grade school and high school. Because of the major discrimination that you faced going from an A student to a C student, you had a really tough time in school. You were expelled from every high school you ever attended, and you looked for jobs, but you couldn't find work in your neighborhood of Blackfoot, Idaho, because of these signs, no Indians or dogs allowed. So you did get your GED.
Yes.
And then you headed for the Bay Area.
Right. Well, I started to feel like, wow, I'm getting jacked out of my my education. You know, I need to, I don't know what everybody's problem is, why they don't like me. But, you know, it didn't shake me to the point where I thought I was really undeserving or feeling bad about it. I just kept going. I didn't care what they thought. I'll just keep going. I'll do what I can.
So you came to Oakland with friends. You went back home, but then you got on the BIA relocation program and came back to San Francisco on that in January 1965. Remind us, what was that relocation program about?
Well, if you because of the reservation status and the poverty and everything everybody's going through, and you try to find jobs and you go off the reservation, and, you know, you face that discrimination and racism, then it really leaves you no choice but to say, okay, I'm going on relocation. And they sent a lot of Native students from the government boarding schools straight to the cities as well. So there was about 60,000 young people sent into the biggest cities of the United States. And, of course, you know, we were young. I was, 18, but, you know, I thought I could deal with it.
Well, and so in many ways, it's like relocation again.
Yes.
Right? Because I'm sure a lot of people wanted to stay with family, but as you said, there were so few opportunities.
I know. I got a job in a restaurant, but when I first went over there, they wouldn't give me the job. They said that they forgot to take the sign out of the window.
Was that that was the restaurant job?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then another great story.
So my white girlfriend, she was working in the beauty shop. So I went over there and I said, okay, do something with my hair. So she did a bleach on it and put a toner on it. And voila, I'm a blonde. And so I went back to that same restaurant and I got the job. Oh, my God.
Wow.
I knew that they were just being discriminatory, and I don't know when they ever found out I was an Indian, but by that time I was already moving on.
What happened with the hair?
I just dyed another color.
You've got amazing stories about connecting with a woman who ran a boarding home, Mrs. Margaret Pascal in San Francisco. She was offering a boarding home for Indian women. It was a new experience for her. I mean, this is like right in our backyard. And so many people probably just don't know about this. She was an elderly woman full of life. She was in her late 60s. And you really liked her. She taught you a lot.
She was pretty cool. She showed me where to shop and, you know, how to run her home. And pretty soon I was running her home with her. So I became her help.
And you also write that when you met other natives back home, you'd wonder, you know, where are you from? What's your tribe? But when you got here, it was just, oh, yes, another native.
Right.
Let's get together and create a community.
That's right. We never were divided against each other because we're so glad to see another native. We didn't care what tribe they were. It was pretty unifying in that respect.
And then you were looking in the San Francisco phone book to see if anything was listed under American Indians, and you found a listing for the American Indian Historical Society. And at that point, it seems to me that that's when it really launched you into getting involved with activism and politics.
It really did, yeah. Because I found someone who had been working on correcting textbooks in the educational system. We went to the board of directors, and I spoke out. I had little speaking engagements in Palo Alto and different places, and so I saw what they were doing in the city, and I wanted to be of some help.
You were helping other natives find jobs and housing and health resources. These were newly relocated Indians who were brought to San Francisco. What struck you about meeting other natives from other parts of the country?
Well, they're just like you are, and they're trying to figure out what to do, where they can get a job, where they can get some kind of help. And when I worked at the Indian Center, I was the intake person. And to me, it was pretty good because there were more resources out there in the city that we could send our people to, whereas on the reservation, forget it. There were no resources, so It was good to be able to help other relocated Indians find jobs and places to live and health services or things that they needed.
You decided to protest the BIA in San Francisco and Oakland because at one point, you know, they sent people to cities without much support or even a return ticket to go back to visit their families.
Exactly. And you know, because I dealt with intake and I knew the situation that was happening to our people, and like I was just doing this myself, you know, to try to help people. And so then we did have a protest at the BIA to see if we could get them to provide more services rather than just transferring us to the urban ghetto, because we had, you know, we didn't have that kind of education or employment that would, you know, bring us really good jobs and money. And so the only place we had to live was in the urban ghettos. And consequently, we just said, okay, we need higher education.
Mm. Okay, so then fast forward a little bit. By this time, you had two sons who were born in San Francisco. You had unsuccessful attempts to go back to school at San Francisco State and City College of San Francisco. You connected with a program called Aid to Families with Dependent Children. You had a social worker, and at that time you found out that some young black students were getting a chance to go to UC Berkeley.
That's right. And I asked the Reverend Jesse James, who was over the Mission Rebels, to see if he could send me to Berkeley too. And he was all happy, and he said, sure, and I'll connect you, and he did. And that's how I got into Berkeley. He was through the blacks.
Wow. And that's so in January 68, you were the first Native American to attend the to attend UC Berkeley.
Right.
Wow. Now, when you look back at what you dealt with in grade school, and then you look at your experience at UC Berkeley, I mean, at UC Berkeley, you were exposed to a lot of different races. And in 1968, that was the height of incredible activism.
Right.
So what was it like for you just to be in that environment?
It was pretty exciting. It was like just electricity was in the air. It just sparked everywhere. And I loved it. I met people, and I met this gal. I was walking down the street, and I was wearing my moccasins, and she stopped, and she says, "Are you Lenaida?" And I said, "Wow." She says, "I heard there was one Native girl on campus, and it had to be you."
Wow.
So we became really good friends. She was Marie Elena LaRocque. She was from Haiti.
Wow.
But she was from the Native side of Haiti.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Lenaida Wojcik, who is out with a new book called Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. As we said, she was the first Native student at UC Berkeley in 1968 and one of the leaders of the occupation in 1969. We have to kind of go a little fast from here because we only have about 10 minutes left. But I want to ask you, so when you were at UC Berkeley, you met with members of the Chicano organization. They recruited you to join thinking you were Mexican, but you told them that you were Indian, and they thought that was even better because they highly respected Native people and identified with Native ancestry.
True.
And then you organized a Native American student organization, became the chair. Just talk about some of the big moments there and working with other kids on or other students on ethnic studies.
Well, then that's when the idea came up about, well, we called them blacks at the time. That's what they wanted to be called, but now it's Afro. Mm. They were going to start their own studies, and San Francisco State, the strike was going on, the Third World Liberation Front for Black, Chicano, Asian, American Indian Studies. So we decided we would like to have Native American Studies at Berkeley, too. So we joined the strike, and I became one of the Third World leaders because I was the chairman of the student group from Native American Studies for the Native Americans. And I was the only female. They had, like, three or four leaders, but they were so nice. They were so good to me. It was really nice to be around really classy people who just really respected and supported Native Americans.
Over your time in Berkeley, eventually, did other Native kids or Native students enroll while you were there?
Yes, I was able to go out and recruit until I had maybe about 15. That's when we organized our student organization.
And were they were from all over the country?
Well, yes, they were. There were California Indians, a lot of California mm-hmm. Indians, and Natives who were out on relocation.
Because looking at textbooks became really important for you, what did you learn about Native history at UC Berkeley at that time?
We weren't even in the system. They just completely made us invisible, and that's why we wanted to implement our own ethnic studies, because we are alive. We're here. And to us, the only way to combat racism and discrimination is to know who we are, that we exist, to make us legitimate, make us a part of this. Mm-hmm. And let's learn and work together.
When we're talking about curriculum, there's a huge movement to change curriculum to include information about many different races and movements. What are your thoughts about how Indigenous history is taught today? I mean, it's different depending on where you are, but overall.
Well, not only is it important, but I haven't seen a lot of truth yet mm-hmm. come out, you know, because they pretty well whitewash it and hire personnel that, you know, graduated from Stanford or someone who has a real systematic approach to Native Americans, probably never been on a reservation in their life. I mean, it's good they have the academic foundation, but absolutely no knowledge about us.
Right. It seems like there is such a... There's so many new books about Native issues coming out, written by Native Americans, children's books. Because of social media, there's Native Twitter. In fact, you were written up in Teen Vogue. I mean, that's new. That wouldn't 5 years ago, I didn't see anything like that in Teen Vogue.
Oh, I know. I'm not a teenager.
But it is exciting to see change, and people are saying, this is our story, and we want it included in the book. We want to tell our own stories. Yes, thank you, anthropologists.
Yeah.
We're happy that you were there for a while, and you've done good work, right? But now it's our time to tell our own stories.
Right.
What are your thoughts about that? I mean, I feel like here we're getting new books by Natives on a regular basis.
Well, I don't know everything. I can only talk from my perspective and write from my perspective and do my research and do as much as I can, but there are so many stories out there that Native people need to start writing. Mm-hmm. And we need to get it out. And I'm just one of them, but I'm hoping that we can get so many more, because they're really incredible stories to go yet.
Well, I hope that you can get a copy of Dr. Lenita Warjack's book, Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. Find out if it's at your local independent bookstore. If not, you can find the link at yourcallradio.org, and you can order it online. Dr. Warjack, let's talk about Alcatraz. We don't have that much time, but I really wanted to get into your upbringing. I thought that was so important. How much did becoming a student at UC Berkeley and all of the organizing you did there really impact your ability to be involved in organizing the occupation of Alcatraz?
It was what I needed to be strong enough to know what to do, to proceed nonviolently and accomplish as much as you could, you know, in that in the way that we did. So the Hopis came out and left their spiritual message and said we were in there. And that was really incredible. But, yeah, it just gave me the jump start that I needed from the Third World Liberation Front into working together to take Alcatraz. And, of course, we didn't know, had no idea it was going to be as big as it was, but it just started the re-identification of our people and reconnecting with our culture and our past. And so we've been growing over the years like a tree grows. And I'm really happy now that many things have happened. Many people are going back to their culture and their traditions, and we're not assimilated into the mainstream of American society, which was the intent of the federal government at that time. Mm. Also, you can get my book at drwarjack.com. Mm-hmm. At East Wind,
okay,
in Berkeley.
We have those links on our website.
Oh, okay.
What when you were getting together with other Natives talking about this plan, what were those conversations like? Talking about the logistics and the goals and, you know.
We didn't really talk about the specifics. It was just like, okay, let's go meet at the Indian Center and we'll decide what we're going to do. And we went to the Indian Center. And that was after that publicity stunt of Adam Nordwall's. And so we went to the Indian Center and we said, well, let's really take the island, because, I mean, look at Richard. He jumped into the water. And it's really dangerous, you know, but let's get a boat or something and go do it. Okay. So we went to Fisherman's Wharf. And we're waiting for Richard, and he never showed up. And and so I said, well, let me see if I can find a boat. And so some fishermen were coming in with their catch of the day, and I said, can you take us out to Alcatraz? And they said, well, what are you going to do out there? Does that have something to do with what happened today? And I said, well, kind of, but it's separate. And he says, well, where's your clothes and your sleeping bags and everything? And I said, well, it's a ceremony. And then they said, well, don't you have any water? You know, because we never thought of all this specifics. And I said, well, it's a fast. And so they said, okay. So waited, and we waited, and it was getting dark, and their ice was starting to melt, and they had that fish. So I said, okay, let's go. So we left, and we pulled out of the arbor, and then I looked, and I could see outlines of legs running. And so I thought, oh, there they are. Can you go back and pick them up? Had the nerve to ask them after all of that. And they did. Hmm. And they picked up Richard and his guys, and we went out to the island.
Wow.
So there wasn't a lot of, you know.
Not a lot of planning around the logistics.
Yeah. I mean, you know, just the water. I just said, well, it's a fast. Because, you know, we go into 4-day fast without any food or water. Hmm. So, you know, it's not.
What did it feel like when you landed on the island?
It was fantastic. The view was amazing with lights all over the island. And it was just kind of a really exciting time. And then right away, you know, because the students were on the mainland and they were letting the press know that we were on the island. And so we were hiding out in all different places, and we'd see feet walking above us, by us, and they had searchlights from helicopters, but they couldn't find us. So it was pretty exciting.
When you look back at what you accomplished, what really stands out for you?
Just the reconnection with our culture that was taken away by law, and our spirituality, and, well, of course, the identification of becoming who we were, because there were a lot of people that could not claim to be Native. Say in California, for instance, it was really difficult because of the racism and discrimination.
Well, Dr. Wojcik, we'd love to have you back to talk more about Alcatraz. I could have spent the whole hour on that, but I really wanted to go into your background because I learned so much about you from your book. Dr. Lenita Wojcik is author of Native Resistance, An Intergenerational Fight for Survival and Life. Dr. Wojcik was one of the leaders of the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969, and before Alcatraz, she became the first Native student at UC Berkeley in 1968. She helped lead the Third World Liberation Front and the creation of Native American Studies at UC Berkeley. She's a member of the Shoshone-Bannock Tribes, president of Indigenous Visions Network, and a distinguished professor at Boise State University. Dr. Wojcik, thank you so much for sharing your story, and thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. And again, you can find information about how to get your hands on Dr. Wojcik's book, Native Resistance, at your independent bookstore, or you can find links at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Sho McPullen for producing today's show, and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.